This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Hello, good evening and welcome. I'm Alec Hogg and this is the final episode of the BizNews briefing for the year. Yeah, we're kicking off with our holidays, or Bronwyn and I are anyway, from Monday, but we'll be back again on the 6th of January. Enjoy it until then. And we've got quite a show to end off our year with. The Didata protagonists were using lawfare at the same time that they were trying to do the dodgy deal that landed them in so much hot water with Judge Denise Fisher. We've got the two guys on the other end of this deal who will be premiering in full at 8 o'clock tonight, but a highlight for you this evening. Our other premiere this evening is at 8 o'clock, at 7 o'clock rather, with Stafford Marcy, who's got a highlight of that as well in tonight's show. So lots coming up in the next half hour. But let's get straight into that top story. In 2019, Dimension Data's lease on the Randview data center, a 10-year lease it was coming up for renewal. And so the co-owners got together with Dimension Data to discuss whether Didata was going to carry on with it. And here is the co-owner, Graham Roy. And the rest of the story is pretty self-explanatory.
Jerry and I, we would like them to stay on for the further 5 years. They had an option of renewal. And we thought we would enter into normal negotiations, as most businessmen do. So we prepared for a meeting. We set up at the data center. And that's when we, met up. We walked into the boardroom. And we were met up with a guy called Sean Seeliger. And his partner is Martin Epstein. Now, he came into this meeting and duly introduced himself. And I'll say word for word. He says, "I'm Jeremy Ord's a private property portfolio representative." He said, "Well, excuse me, why are we talking to you? We're here to negotiate an extension of the lease with Dimension Data." He said he has a full mandate from the board to represent Dimension Data. But you claiming to represent Jeremy Ord's private property portfolio. He says, yes, that's how it's going to work. And they're going to buy the building from us, buy it or rent it from us. And if we don't sell it to them, they will force us to sell. And then he then grabbed the lease that we had. And he threw it at us across the table. I've never had a lease thrown at me in a business meeting. And he said, "Our building is worth nothing." And he says, best we sell the building or give them a reasonable rent. And Jerry, what else can you remember on that meeting?
They valued the building as such as a valuation of the building at 34 million, and they wanted to pay us a rent of 231,000 rand a month, more or less. It was somewhere. Was that right, Graham? 230?
That's correct. Yeah, 34 million. Yeah. That's correct. And we valued it at 311 million.
Whoa.
Yeah, so there was quite a huge, and I think the important thing, it wasn't about the valuation of the building. It was a valuation about what rent should be paid. And so they valued it at their valuer came in and said the rent that should be paid is 231, and our valuer came in and said the rent should be 4 million a month. The meeting of the valuers, which was recorded, and we have the transcript of that, clearly indicated that the valuers that were representing Didata were instructed by Didata on how to value this building. They never contacted us. They never actually followed any methodology which took into account a data center as such. They merely valued a warehouse.
You've given us the parallels of what happened with the Judge Denise Fisher's whole judgment. And you went to court in a completely separate matter, as you've explained. And that was what, Graham, what you were saying took 3 years of your life and 4 million rand in legal fees.
Yeah, correct. And then what's important is this is Steve Nathan had a lot of correspondence with me as well. And he said to us, we will never comply with what the lease agreement says. And if you must remember, if not, we will see you in the constitutional court. Well, you know, I don't know. The bully boy tactics just went on and on and on. You know, a data center is not something somebody can pack up and go. You know, it's not like you can, it would take probably about 2 years to move out the building. But this is why they always knew they couldn't move out. And we were prepared to negotiate a reasonable lease. We were prepared to negotiate a reasonable rental, but they just came in strong arm bully boy tactics. And exactly what they, by the looks of the judgment, exactly what they did there, where they were determined to get that building for Jeremy Ord's private income.
So the point that you make there about going all the way to the Constitutional Court, Jerry, that would suggest it was lawfare, as they call it, warfare using legal means.
Yeah, there's no doubt that it was lawfare. I mean, we were dealing with their legal team was Evershed, and on numerous occasions we objected to some of the tactics that they employed. We objected to what we considered to be false affidavits, because what the people that were writing the affidavits weren't even there when the lease was signed, and they had no knowledge of what the intent of the lease was at the time that it was signed.
From your description, you were being bullied, Graham, into paying 200 odd thousand rand a month in rental to a organization that very clearly said that we act on behalf of Jeremy Ord, the co-founder of Didata. Is that what you're telling us?
And that's correct.
And the actual market-related rental was at least 10 times that from what Jerry has said a moment ago.
That is correct. And that was the cause of our three-year court case.
I mean, I don't know what the inner workings were, and we weren't privy to it. All we know was that eventually NTT said, we want to settle. Japan wants this off the shelf. They don't want to be fighting this kind of battle when they've got bigger fish to fry on the other side. So, you know, we just small guys. We didn't want to get involved in the whole thing until the judgment came out. And I said to Graham, we've been vindicated. What we said right from the outset was the truth. And we didn't understand in all its niceties what was going on. But we said all the way along, in fact, we said it directly to their legal team in one of the board meetings. We said to them that there's something funny going on here. And I actually made a comment in one of the meetings that it was ironic that the very people NTT were suing for fraud were the very same people we were negotiating our lease with, at least initially, and that this had caused the court case to arise. And I said to them, how can you not see the similarities between the two? That the same parties you're fighting with are the same parties that we get ridiculous emails from and ridiculous claims. And we're still not sure who was involved and who wasn't involved. I mean, it's subject to speculation, and I don't want to speculate at this point what it might have been. But our opinion from the start was that there was something funny going on when they started renegotiating this lease. The judgment now tells us that it was all coming together at the same time. The MBO was put on the shelf, and I think my opinion is that the limited partners then decided to carve out various assets. I'm not sure where our lease stood in that buyout, where it stood, but they were obviously pushing for a very low value, as was Steve Nathan pushing for a very low value for the campus. He was pushing for a very low value for our data center. So I can only presume or surmise in some way that they'd found a method of capturing a very lucrative cash flow at a minimal value.
It's a heck of a story, and the full interview which runs to about 45 minutes, is our premiere for tonight. It really is something where you can see that the small guys, and mostly the small guys, capitulate because they can't go all the way to the Constitutional Court and spend years and years and years at hundreds of thousands of rand a month paying lawyers. But in this case, these two guys decided they weren't going to capitulate. They were going to fight it. And in the end, they won because the Japanese decided that once they had looked at it properly, that these guys were in the right and the former management and executives of Dimension Data in the wrong. And there are parallels, what happened here, with the Dimension Data case on the campus, the BEE transaction that wasn't, that was exposed in the judgment by Judge Denise Fisher. Strangely enough, that judgment has come under a lot of criticism from all kinds of quarters, including, not surprisingly, the Data executives themselves. The truth will out. It always is. Similarly, we now move on to another big story. Donald Trump may, and we don't know for sure, but all the indications are suggesting this, may take the more than, the billions of tons of gold that are sitting in the U.S. reserves, which make up 72% of the total U.S. reserves. They're sitting there at $44, so hugely undervalued. He may sell some of that to buy Bitcoin and to put Bitcoin into the reserve. And this is something that would have shockwaves all over the world. Stafford Marcy is a tech guru and Bitcoin maximalist, as he calls himself. And I asked him to give us some insight into this, and particularly in this clip of the conversation, can he tell us a bit about Trump's new Bitcoin and AI czar, the South African-born David Sacks?
I know his history. I mean, when I was in the payments industry, I started a payments startup, and we were very deeply embedded in electronic payments. And we were so deeply embedded in them that you start to understand who's the who around the world when it comes to payments. And obviously, David Sacks is part of the PayPal founders. You know, when Musk started PayPal, there's quite a few of them. There's Peter Thiel. You know, he was part of that. And Peter Thiel is actually in Namibia. People don't know that.
Namibian.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he's got Namibia as a background. I think, I stand on a correction, but I think that he's got Namibia as where he was born and where he was raised. And then you got David Sacks, South African, and then you got Elon Musk. So there's a lot of South Africans, and David Sacks has a podcast, I think a podcast called All In, and it's a podcast that I listen to quite often. And he's quite vocal around, you know, Trump. He was very vocal around the Ukraine war, but I respect him for his technological views. But he approaches it from a venture capital perspective. And what's impressive is what Trump's doing. I mean, irrespective of what you think of Trump, the man, et cetera, he is coalescing and coagulating very interesting skill sets from an economic technology perspective inside the White House. I mean, these are thought leaders. These are people that really know what they're talking about. And Sacks is one of them. Sacks understands crypto. He understands he's an investor. He was an investor. He understands Bitcoin innately. There's recordings of him talking about the attributes of Bitcoin, why it's unique, its value proposition. And, you know, having that acumen inside of a legislative entity as powerful as the White House is very, very exciting. And I think it leans into where Donald Trump is going to be going here with some of these assets. I mean, his son got up this week at the Middle East and North Africa conference, the Bitcoin conference, and I think it was in Abu Dhabi. And he did a speech, and I actually shared that speech. Now, I'm not a fan of Eric Trump. I'm not a Donald Trump fan. Don't get me wrong. But what Eric Trump said on stage was quite profound. I listened to that speech from the beginning till the end. And my word, do they get Bitcoin? I mean, these are things that we've been saying forever. I mean, it was years ago that I got onto the business stage for the first time and spoke about Bitcoin. And 99% of the audience had never heard of it and had never traded with it, etc. All the way to now seeing people like Jerome Powell talking about Bitcoin, I think this week or last week, saying it's akin to gold. And he compares it to the attributes that gold has, but it's digital gold. Profound. Putin comes out on stage this week and talks about Bitcoin being immutable and not being able to put. And then, you know, Eric Trump gets up on stage. And go listen to that speech. And that will give you some insight into what Trump is going to be doing with these assets when he's in power. And one thing that we've very focused on is whether he will move from saying he's going to have a Bitcoin reserve pile. That's those are his words, and whether that will translate into a strategic Bitcoin reserve asset that sits within the Federal Reserve and that's utilized for all the attributes that it will be utilized for. If that should occur, I think that's quite profound. And Eric Trump, for me, lifted the lid on that more so than anyone else did, because he spoke about his dad. He spoke about Bitcoin's value proposition as a strategic asset. He spoke about it being digital gold. He spoke about the store of value attributes of it. He spoke about all the things that we've been saying for years and years as Bitcoin maximalists. He was saying it on stage, and he kept on talking about his dad implementing that and personifying all of that within the context of the United States. And as a South African, first of all, as a Bitcoin maximalist, I'm extremely excited. That is extraordinary. As a hodler, as someone that's spoken about this asset forever, finally the world is waking up to what it is. And it's glorious. We're loving it. As a South African, I'm petrified. I'm very, very concerned. Why am I concerned? I'm concerned because our leadership don't fully comprehend what this is. They still consider it as an asset, you know, coin go up, coin go down. And unfortunately, we've got so many of these other little crypto token things all around that are flashy and volatile, and they attract everyone. And I want to differentiate from that. So I don't speak for the crypto industry. I speak for Bitcoin as a Bitcoin maximalist. And if you take a look at Bitcoin and you consider what Trump could potentially do here. So let's think about that for a second. What Trump could do within the first couple of months, he could move the confiscated Bitcoin that sits under the auspice of the FBI right now. And that's over 200,000 Bitcoins. He could move those assets into the Federal Reserve, and they could be reclassified as a strategic reserve asset. He could bring to pass Senator Loomis's bill. And the bill is very simple. The bill says we should create and establish a Bitcoin strategic reserve, number one. Number two is we should buy 1 million Bitcoin over 5 years. Number three is we will not touch that Bitcoin for a minimum of 20 years, right? And if we do touch it, we'll touch it to pay off the national debt. Now, if you take a look at all of this noise happening and you see states in the United States, I think it's Wyoming, that has announced a strategic Bitcoin reserve, and we're going to hear more and more of this happening on a state level in the United States. If this all comes to pass, I sit in a country as a South African, and I'm watching this, and this reminds me of Blockbuster with Netflix and the internet. This reminds me of newspapers when they said the internet's just a fad. This reminds me when people said open source software is nothing. I think we now have a national state emergency on our hands. I think if we see the world, which Trump is possibly doing, moving away from a global gold standard, and they start sunsetting that and they move towards a global digital gold standard, what does that mean for South Africa? That should scare the living. I mean, that should really, really stop us as leaders.
It's a fascinating interview. It premieres at 7 o'clock tonight. And just to clarify, the U.S. has got $500 billion worth of gold assets. It doesn't have billions of tons. I apologize for that. And what he was saying right at the outset and often has been telling us, Stafford Marcy, is that in his opinion, we had fire, then we had the wheel, and now we got Bitcoin. So that is how dramatic it is. If you don't know anything about Bitcoin, there's plenty, plenty on the BizNews TV channel that you can go and pick up on. Well, coming closer to home now, our colleague Linda van Tilburg caught up with Tourism Minister Patricia de Lille. And what was so interesting about this interview and the clip you're going to hear in a moment is that the tourism minister was herself caught up in the chaos on Monday when something broke that should never have broken at OR Tambo. Let's listen in.
South African Tourism Minister Patricia de Lille has just returned from a trip to India to strengthen tourism ties with her Indian counterpart. And she was also caught up in the delays at OR Tambo Airport following a refueling problem at the airport. Well, before we discuss your trip to India, so what happened? Were you also caught because of that, waiting at the airport because of this refueling problem?
Yes, I was stuck in the plane for 2 hours. First of all, The pilot announced that we are waiting on a parking bay before we can land. They finally, after 20 minutes, allocated the parking bay. We then landed and the pilot announced that we are now in a queue waiting for staircases and the buses to come. That took another hour. When the staircase finally arrived, people still had to wait for the buses to get off the plane. And for me, it was really so worrying because that flight was also full of tourists and business people. And, you know, just the brand for South Africa and the way people are received, the knock-on effect of people having missed their connecting flights. And, you know, just some ordinary South Africans that have saved the whole year for their holiday trips, and they also missing connecting flights. So I was very disappointed and concerned, but also that it is clear that the airport's company did not make sure that they are ready for the peak season. Before a peak season, you normally do maintenance. You check that your contingency plans are in place. But it was absolute chaos. When I finally got to the arrival hall, there were 8 buses parked there. People were just sitting in the buses as if they didn't know where to go. So I have called for a meeting with the Minister of Transport, Minister Barbara Creasy. She's also very concerned about it. And I'm waiting to hear back from her office. Because my concern, Linda, is that they can't give us a guarantee that it's not going to happen again. And that is really my concern, why I want to meet with the minister.
So what measures do you want them to take?
The measures that I want them to take is to bring all stakeholders together to make sure that they've got a plan in place, that they've got a contingency plan in place in the event it happens again. But also, this is not the first time we had this problem. It started way back in 2022. And I went to go look at a question that was answered by the then Minister of Transport to a member of parliament, and the reasons and the excuses and what they were going to do. But the then minister also made reference to infrastructure and the maintenance of infrastructure. So I hope we can get our act together because we're expecting a bumper tourism season.
You go for them, Auntie Pat. Isn't it lovely to see these ministers in the Government of National Unity standing up and letting their voices be heard? But boy, I mean, that's like your worst nightmare. Your big boss arriving on the day that everything goes wrong. Ouch. Well, I'm sure we'll hear more from AXA, and that hopefully that is a warning signal and will enable a happy tourism season, because South Africa really needs it. Something else that's going on in the world right now and actually grabbing the headlines internationally is the way that Donald Trump is cozying up, you might call it, to the Chinese Premier Xi, who he has invited to his inauguration. Our partners at Bloomberg had a look at the implications of this.
It's an olive branch for sure. And he is trying to create a friendlier environment when he has stacked his administration with China hawks, basically. And of course, created the, or really kind of kicked off the trade war with China during his first administration as well. So this kind of feels like a little bit of an olive branch to say, hey, let's start off on a good term. Will he accept is the $1 million question? The likelihood is a no, but we'll see if that is simply because we know that since those comments were made on and I believe CBS Reports suggested this as well. Since that was broken, you did see comments coming out of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs over in China saying, we do actually want to negotiate with the United States. We do actually want to talk about trade terms, et cetera. I think the context is really important here in that Donald Trump had talked to Xi Jinping in his first administration and had brokered a trade deal, one that included agricultural quotas as well on things like soybeans, on things like corn, on things like pork imports, for example, as well, and that kind of thing. quotas that China did not fulfill in terms of purchasing agreements. So this is really also, from a domestic perspective, something that Donald Trump has to prove, that he can not only broker an agreement, he can see the follow through as well.
And look, it's interesting to draw this this latest development, as reported by CBS, to what we have seen in terms of signals coming out of the new Trump administration as well. You mentioned the appointment of some China hawks as well into the key positions in the administration.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating one as well, because we know we've been covering the Canadian and the Mexican tariff commentary as well that he'd put on Truth Social. None of that, of course, official American policy yet, but very well could be come January 20th. A lot of that is baked into the China story as well, because part of that trade agreement has also meant tougher kind of controls on the Chinese fentanyl story as well. And that is exports that come from China into Mexico and into the United States, feeding the opioid crisis in the United States. So that is another area where some of the China hawks in his administration, I'm specifically thinking of Marco Rubio, who's been very, very vocal on this, is coming to the forefront. He is also another example of things like TikTok and how that's being aggressively handled in the United States, talking about potential delistings of Chinese companies that are on the New York Stock Exchange and are on the NASDAQ that haven't met certain accounting requirements for the exchange, but also haven't been penalized for not meeting those accounting requirements. These are all conversations we had 4 years ago, Stephen and Val. And now that they're coming back again, it's crucial to talk about what China is actually coming back with. And right now, we don't actually know how they're going to respond. And all we really know is they're getting kind of on the defensive in terms of their domestic monetary policy in anticipation that things may get tough for them.
Mm. Yeah, what's the latest thinking about the inflationary impact from tariffs? I know that economists have been weighing up the downside hit to growth with the possible cost shocks from tariffs. What's the latest thinking there?
Well, this was a kind of controversial commentary over the weekend. Donald Trump actually speaking to NBC and saying, well, this is going to be something that could increase costs for millions of Americans. And this is the first time he's actually admitted that tariffs could be inflationary. And the reason this is so important as well is that, remember on the campaign trail, both sides, both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, even Joe Biden when he was in the race, were talking about how to decrease costs for millions of Americans. Because right after immigration and the border, the economy was the second biggest voting issue. So for him to actually say, now that I've been elected, maybe the American people do have to feel a little bit of pain, that's a big deal. And he's now basically in consensus, to your point, with what a lot of economists and market participants are saying.
It's a story that are we going to have an interesting next 5 or next 4 years when Trump is in the White House? Today, it was interesting, as it always is, on the stock market, but as you can see, if you're watching on screen or if you're listening, the resources were down 0.33%. Industrials just about unchanged. Financials down 0.5%, and the top 40 index 0.25% lower. So no fireworks on the JSE today. Bitcoin was off a little, but it's still over $100,000 right now, sitting at $101,000. The rand was firm; it held on to its recent gain, R17.75. Against the US dollar and R22.53 against the pound. Both of those very slight increases. And as far as the markets are concerned, a rare good day for Sasol. It's down nearly 50% for the year to date, but it picked up 3.7% today. Argent Industrial added to that fine performance it's had so far this year. It was the 2.9% gainer there, up 82% year to date. Baldwin Properties, after results, has been very firm, up 2.8%, and it's now moved very strongly into the positive 19% year to date. And then Barlow World, which is subject to the takeover offer of $1.3 billion from a Saudi company, and that was up by another 2.7% today, or 38% year to date. It was lagging quite badly up until the offer that came in. On the way down, We Buy Cars, just profit-taking, really. The share price down 4.5% after a fantastic run. In fact, it's been one of the featured stocks for most of the past few weeks. Year-to-date, 142% firmer. So I suppose a breather was in order. Purple down 2.8%. It's still up 50% year-to-date. Sibanye hasn't had a good year this year, 24% down in the year, and it's part of that, nearly 3% of that came today. And then Stefanuti Stocks, which, like We Buy Cars, has done very well after results, and that's just given back a little bit of the recent gains. Well, we've got a couple of great premieres for you tonight. At 7 o'clock this evening, you can tune in to that chat with Stafford Marcy. That's on the BizNews TV channel. And then at 8 o'clock is the story about the dodgy deal that the Didata protagonists, as described in Judge Denise Fisher, were conducting with another party. And these are two small businessmen who put together a data center 25 years ago. Well, they put together a company 25 years ago, which had property, and they first of all rented it out to Xerox. But it's all in the premiere, as you can listen at 8 o'clock. It is really one of those must-listen or must-watch interviews. That's it for us for this year, in fact. We're off on holiday from Monday. The BizNews will continue throughout the whole of the holiday season. News never stops. But the BizNews briefing is taking a break until the 6th of January. Look forward to being back in your company then. From the team of our technical producer, Ruan Erasmus, our executive producer, Lucy Ferreira, and yours truly, Alec Hogg, and of course, my co-presenter, Bronwyn Nielsen. Have a wonderful Christmas and festive season, and may 2025 bring you everything that you deserve and pray for. Until then, cheerio. This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.